my law firms are having a shelter at home. They're having to work at home. They're having to get their workforce set up at home, but they were not required to shut down. For my dentists, for my veterinarians, and for my optometrists, some of my vets were considered essential services. Some of them are emergency only. Just about every dentist and every optometrist was told to shut down completely and only handle emergency cases.
Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast, Tom Bowden of Buckingham Strategic Wealth. So I wanted to have Tom on here for a couple reasons today. One is, you know, he's a chartered financial analyst, has the chartered financial analyst designation like I do. So, you know, already has a sort of a check mark with that. And then he's also really experienced in dealing with some complicated financial planning issues for business owners and practice owners that I think you're going to be really, really interested in. So, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Travis. Appreciate being here.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what your background is?
Yeah, sure. So currently I am a practice integration advisor for Buckingham Strategic Wealth, lead that team and assist with the management and the development of that business line where we work with practice owners in their wealth creation. Before that, I worked at the Indiana Attorney General's office, was the CFO there for a number of years, and very handy right now was the chief economist there for several years where I did settlement negotiations, econometric modeling, and most importantly, legislative analysis. So as we're going through with the CARES Act and we've got these federal responses to help small business owners, it's been really glad I had that background.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you later about how we avoid getting thrown in jail for PPP fraud, but maybe later on that one. So just so our listeners know, so I'm very picky about who we have referral relationships with. Buckingham Strategic Wealth is a referral partner for Student Loan Planner. So if you did hire them for financial planning, we might get compensated. So I just wanted everybody to know that just as a little disclosure out of the way, but that's because I believe in what you guys are doing, your investment philosophy, your strategies, the potential value add. So that's the reason for that. So first off, Tom, what's going on right now? I mean, what kind of questions are people asking you? Are people freaking out because of this pandemic? Like, what are you hearing from the many different professionals and business owners that you advise? And I guess, you know, we didn't even really make clear exactly what kind of professionals you advise. So maybe if you can include that in your answer, that'd be great too.
Yeah, sure. That practice integration advisor piece of it, like I mentioned, we kind of use the practice for the acceleration of wealth creation. So my team works primarily with practice owners and kind of defining practice owners, primarily dental practice owners, but I also do a lot of work in the legal space with veterinarians, with optometrists. And as we're going through this just wild time period, that's been an interesting separation. My law firms are having a shelter at home. They're having to work at home. They're having to get their workforce set up at home, but they were not required to shut down. For my dentists, for my veterinarians, and for my optometrists, some of my vets were considered essential services. Some of them are emergency only. Just about every dentist and every optometrist was told to shut down completely and only handle emergency cases, which, I mean, you can imagine for a business owner when your federal government comes in and says, look, for the next couple of months, you're not going to be able to do business as usual. Vast majority of your productions, vast majority of your revenue producing activities are just disallowed. It's been a pretty crazy time to be advising them. Now, thankfully, there's been a couple of federal responses that are able to be helpful. And then there were a lot of advanced planning items that for those who we were working with for the last several years find themselves in this situation where, you know, when we talk about emergency cash savings and we talk about that on the personal side and in the practice side and having access to a line of credit and not using that line of credit unless it's emergency. Previously, we'd talk about what is an emergency. Well, it's the unusual, it's the unexpected, and it's the infrequent. I think we're hitting that right about now.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, in our data, we did a survey of thousands of our readers, and we found optometrists and dentists were the worst hit by far. You know, so we saw some veterinarians getting shut down or getting their revenues pretty significantly restricted. But, you know, by and large, you know, it seems like most of the veterinarians we could see in our data were at least surviving okay. But as of the most recent survey we did in mid-April for dentists and optometrists, more than half of them were not earning an income at all. You know, so I mean, talk about stunning. I mean, that's two of the most stable professions that you can really think of pre-pandemic, you know, and just kind of amazing how these very stable professions just overnight or a lot of people are now earning nothing. I mean, that poses some massive challenges to financial planning, I'd assume.
And that study was really great. It took a lot of the, you know, kind of a priori evidence, those single pieces that I'm working on as I'm working with my dentist specifically, my optometrist specifically. And then I looked over that study and it was just, yeah, that's what they're feeling. You know, again, that gets back to that value of financial planning and having a plan as we go into and through your career as a business owner. Because when you get to that place of owning your own practice, you know, you're the one who's holding the ball at the end of the day. You're responsible for payroll. A lot of the dentists and optometrists that own their own practice, you know, they went through clinical school. And obviously your information is wonderful because they're coming out with some massive debt and student loans, really leveraging that earnings opportunity. But then also when you get to that position of being a practice owner, now you got a little bit that additional risk that you have in terms of a practice owner should be translating to additional return in terms of your compensation, that ability to extract profit from your business.
Yeah. So we have a lot of practice owners that listen to this podcast, but we have even more people that are not yet practice owners that are interested in it. You know, I'm a very strong advocate for practice ownership. You know, you're not opening a restaurant, you're opening something that's got a relatively low chance of failure, that's got, you know, a lot of chance of increasing your wealth significantly. But we're seeing practice owners are basically the hardest hit group of professionals out there for this recession. And so I'm hearing from a lot of listeners, hey, you know what? I mean, this is kind of just showing me why being an associate for the long term is a great decision. And they're saying, I really want the security that comes with being an associate and not having to have the stress of managing my business during this kind of a time frame. So what are you saying to that? I mean, if you've heard that from anybody out there, how do you respond to those charges that, you know what, practice ownership after this is just going to look completely different?
You know, there's kind of the near-term answer to that and the long-term answer to that. When we look at the near-term answer to that, you know, the big miss that you have when it comes to the federal relief that we're seeing in some of the loan programs within the CARES Act is ultimately what would look like income replacement for associates. The vast majority of associates have either the entirety of their compensation or a significant portion of their compensation tied to a percentage of production. And so that is pretty much completely evaporated. And as we look at that ability for income replacement through the CARES Act or income replacement through expanded unemployment that we have in these federal packages, you know, it's a far cry from what an associate was previously earning. And when we get back to business as usual, they're going to be the ones that are going to kind of have to be, I don't want to say second seat after the practice owner, but the practice owner is going to have to prioritize the production and the hygiene work that's going to be able to support the office staff, not necessarily shifting that production back to an associate. So while it feels secure looking at it from the onset, quite a bit of what's going to happen as we move through the near term isn't necessarily going to be that full income replacement that a lot of associates were hoping that they'd be able to get. Hopefully we see that coming right back on. And then in terms of the long term and, you know, why would I want to stay as an associate versus being a practice owner as we go through a period like this? I mean, you already mentioned it when you compared buying a dental practice versus buying a restaurant. We've got the ability to not go out and eat. We've got the ability as consumers to make a lot of those decisions. However, as I look at the long-term trend of dentistry and the need for this medical service across multiple communities, you know, I just don't see that disappearing in 2 years and in 5 years.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I would kind of take it a step further. I mean, some of the dentists in the most concentrated areas, already the worst areas to be practice owners in terms of, you know, overhead and number of professionals per population, right? Those happen to be in coastal areas, urban areas, very desirable, you know, places to live that might have, you know, 1,000 people per dentist or something, right? And then you're seeing some of these people more out of the way, more rural places that might have, you know, 5,000 people per dentist that, you know, are reopening sooner or having, you know, maybe a little bit more emergency cases that people are able to do because specialists aren't as widespread, right? I mean, you know, some of the work that would go an endodontist or would go to an oral surgeon maybe is going to you because there's not anybody, you know, alternatively that they can go to. So, you know, I think we're seeing this big bifurcation, you know, within dentistry and other professions too, where practice ownership in Northern New Jersey is going to continue to be difficult. I think, you know, I mean, you're going to see more and more competition in a hyper competitive market. Companies get big to compete because of the high fixed costs, you know, the high competition. And so I think that, you know, we're kind of seeing sort of extrapolations done by people that I don't think are necessarily fair, where they're saying, hey, you know, the local market that I'm seeing here with private practice owners with high overhead, you know, in San Francisco, I mean, this is just the end of dentistry as we know it. Whereas I'm seeing a lot of people in some of our higher income, you know, less competitive areas that are getting their PPP loans to cover overhead, and they're going to be crushing it after this because people are going to be scared to go be their own bosses. I mean, that's my biggest concern is, and what I think is going to happen is people are going to get cold feet about being owners after this, which is going to increase the returns to practice ownership even more. I'm wondering how you feel about that statement.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with it. I'm sitting here in the peninsula, just a little bit south of San Francisco. And as I look at the makeup and the profitability of some of the practices in this really, really congested area, you know, I mean, general dentistry, bread and butter dentistry, not that it's impossible to start a practice or to buy a profitable practice, but you have a lot more elements of competition, whereas a lot of the specialists are able to be a lot more nimble, even in highly dense populated area. But one of the things that we see quite often is, you know, as we benchmark practices, help owners understand their cash flow, you know, there's a lot of trends in the numbers based off of the geography that they're in and the community that they serve that can either restrict what those opportunities look like going forward, or they can present to that practice owner a lot of different opportunities to take advantage of as well. So knowing what's in your backyard, knowing how to take advantage of it, that's a primary opportunity for any business owner.
Yeah, no, you benchmark a lot of practices. What are some examples of income ranges that you see maybe among dentistry, but also some of the other professions that you advise?
So the widest income range across all of the professions that we advise for practice owners is far and away attorneys. But when we're looking at dentists, you know, that still presents a pretty large spectrum for practice owners. And, you know, some of it can come down to the practice owner wants a lifestyle practice versus an entrepreneurial practice. The practice owner is coming in and it's a startup practice. And when we see those types of practices, we're generally seeing an income or a compensation range of about $225,000 to $275,000. We can find the fee for service that are in the affluent suburban areas that are still able to support a practice without having the insurance drag and the PPO and the collections loss. And some of those that have the expanded services, like you talked about, the general that might be doing placements or full mouth reconstructions, some of those guys, they're bringing in well over $1 million a year.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit. Now, what about the lawyer range? I mean, you know, you said that's the largest range. I'm assuming you're talking about, you know, an 80K family, you know, law kind of place, and then somebody that's doing 500K intellectual property. I mean, is that kind of the range, or what do you see there?
You have that range for the guys who are doing and the gals that are doing kind of that family law, the IP piece of it. You know, then we've got some of those that are the litigators and very successful defense attorneys that, again, you know, they might have 1 year their incomes would be without engineering. 1 year their income might be $1.5 million, and the next year their income might be $60,000. I mean, wow. If we're able to get in front of it and set up a settlement distribution trust and spread some of those dollars for the attorney across a couple of different tax years, yeah, then we're able to do some significant tax savings for them. But kind of live by the sword, die by the sword attorneys can have that huge range, not even just with their attorneys and their associate attorneys, but also themselves as the owners.
What about optometrists and veterinarians, just so we try to not leave anybody out?
No, yeah, I appreciate that. You know, I mean, a lot of times the optometrists that we're working with are really kind of in that about 150 to 350 to 400,000 range, and the vets kind of similarly, but a little bit down. So about 100,000 to, and the kind of highest producing vet that I have brings about $500,000 a year in profit out of the practice.
So that's a lot more than 80,000 to 120,000 working for VCA or Banfield.
Oh yeah. Right. I mean, it's that when you are in the vet business model, you've got so much product that you have moving through. And a lot of times you're your pharmacist as well. There's a variety of different business lines that a veterinary owner is able to take advantage of when it comes to profit centers and really kind of honing in on how do you map revenue coming to your office and maximize all those different channels.
Yeah. So in terms of people that you see doing different kinds of practices. Some of them will open one practice and try to make it a mega practice. Some people will do lifestyle. Some people will do multiple practice locations. What do you see as the most popular activity that professionals will do when they're looking to scale their business?
I really think it comes down to the individual and what's their ideal career look like. It's the difference between the clinician who owns a business and a business owner who happens to be a clinician. I work with some dentists that are very entrepreneurial. They're doing the multi-practice thing. They're really enjoying it. They don't mind the HR aspect of it. They like trying to find those different opportunities and those buying opportunities, and they do a great job. I've got others who really, really high-end clinicians. They make their name in their market by the differentiation and service that they provide, but they're not as turned on by some of the HR challenges that they have, some of the business management challenges that they have, and they're just really comfortable owning one practice and really trying to maximize it. That individual who's the clinician who happens to be the business owner, if I'm in the sideline cheering them on to try to buy and grab more practice locations or open up more practice locations, it's not going to be the same fulfilling career. Similarly, if I've got the entrepreneur who happens to be a clinician and I'm telling them just to focus on a single location, they're going to feel like they outgrew it a while ago and they're going to get a little frustrated. They're not taking advantage of some of the opportunities. So really knowing that clinician's desire for what their career life looks like, that then gives us the opportunity to help them define those opportunities, price the opportunities, and make those acquisitions or build out those practices in addition.
What would you say is the difference between the terminal net worth of somebody who decided to become a practice owner versus somebody that was content being an associate long term?
Yeah, the associate long term, I mean, that terminal net worth, again, it can come down to saving strategies. It can come down to the risk tolerance on the investment side of things. There's a lot of different items that will influence the future dispersion of what that terminal value is ultimately going to look like. But in general, on the associate side of things, that kind of peak net worth, good planning, making sure that you get to financial freedom, 2 million, 4 million, whereas on the practice owner side of things, and then kind of going back to your prior question of those that are the entrepreneurs, are killing it, are expanding their practices, are trying to get multiple streams of income coming in across multiple practices, don't mind bringing on and managing a good deal of associates. I've got some of those clients that are in the range of about $15 to $20 million.
That's a big difference.
Big difference. Oh yeah, big difference.
And you can be somewhere in between that and have more of a lifestyle-based practice too, right? I mean, you know, you can become an owner and work 3 or 4 days instead of 5 days a week, and maybe have double that net worth and have just really relaxing, amazing lifestyle too, right? It doesn't have to be either or.
It's everywhere in that range. You got it, right? I mean, how do we kind of right size based off of your lifestyle desires, based off of your career desires, based off of, you know, what you want financial freedom to look like? What's life look like after you hang up the pliers, as one of my ortho dentists would always put it. But that's it, right? I mean, what kind of fits best for you as the individual and build the plan around the individual, and anywhere in that spectrum can be workable as long as it aligns with spending patterns and what your professional desires are.
So we have a great desire among our clients to try to minimize their adjusted gross income, because student loan payments are a percentage of that, of adjusted gross income. The lower you can get that AGI, the better it is, obviously, from a tax perspective, but also the much better it is from a student loan perspective. And one of the most interesting opportunities available to, you know, especially healthcare professionals, because of how stable those incomes are typically, is a cash balance plan, which can allow you to put away a lot more money pre-tax than a 401k plan can do. But it's something that's complicated enough that I would never suggest that anybody try to run it themselves. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. And you know, is it true that healthcare professionals in particular could be putting away six figures for their retirement annually instead of the 19,500 limit?
Yes. Yes, it is. That is a true statement. One of my mentors, Ned Kivett, described a cash balance plan as a chainsaw. When you take a chainsaw to a job that needs a chainsaw, there's no substitute for it. If you take a chainsaw to a job that didn't need a chainsaw, that can cause a lot of destruction. So a cash balance plan is a type of defined benefit plan. So when we think about defined benefit plans, a lot of us think that that kind of went away from when we went through kind of the pension era and moved more towards individuals funding up their own 401ks and that defined contribution model. So that pension plan design is still out there. Dentists, a lot of law firms, a lot of vets, and a lot of optometrists oftentimes have ideal demographics that the owner is able to keep a substantial percentage of the dollars of those benefits that are accrued on an annual basis. When we look at that 401k, our ability to contribute is metered by what the federal government says, what those maxes are. We can only defer a certain amount per year. There's only a certain amount per year that we can get in profit sharing. There's some substantial savings that we can do there, but it is not going to be the same level as what you have with a defined benefit plan, where an individual might be accruing $100,000, $150,000 in benefits each year. When we think about the most common pension plan that still is in existence today, those government plans, all the time we're hearing from the news about those being underfunded. Well, a pension can also be overfunded. So when we're working with our clients, getting a deep understanding of their lifestyle, getting a deep understanding of exactly how much do we have left over for savings, how can we set up a cash balance plan to be a supplement for wealth creation, not an obligation that takes away from what their lifestyle expenditure or their desired lifestyle expenditure happens to be. We're able to design plans that have, you know, maybe a minimum funding of $30,000 to $50,000 with a maximum funding of $200,000, $250,000.
Pre-tax?
Pre-tax. You got it. And then that comes in and that is able to bring down what their AGI looks like, what their taxable income looks like. Right now, after the 2018 Tax Act, where we've got the opportunity to take advantage of QBI, the Qualified Business Income Deduction. You know, I had a dentist in Texas who had about $600,000 in profit from his practice, general dentist, been doing it for a long time, just a little bit north of Houston. And we were able to build and design the cash balance plan that we got his income right down to $314,700. And so he had about $150,000 where he had that 20% reduction based off of QBI and pass-through. We had several hundred thousand dollars that did not get taxed at that highest marginal rate, because that's where we kind of take that off of the equation. Guy had $600,000 in terms of profitability. When you compare that against his tax bill, yeah, he was paying about a 12% federal tax rate and pre-tax supercharging what he was putting aside for retirement and wealth creation.
Yeah, and people didn't understand, I don't think, how important the AGI that you just mentioned was because of the QBI deduction, right? You have the cap where a married couple cannot earn more than, and you would know the number exactly, probably more than me, but it's 300 something thousand, right? Do you happen to know the limit off the top of your head?
315,000. So if a married couple comes in and their AGI is 315,000 for any income that is passed through, so what you get, you know, in terms of a draw from your practice versus a W-2 from your practice, all that income is reduced by 20% for tax purposes. At 315,000, you get the full 20%. By the time we get to 415,000, that has gone down to zero. So anytime that we're able to right-size lifestyle and savings, pre-tax savings, to engineer income for practice owners, we get this great double bite at the tax savings and strategy.
Yeah, and that's because when you get under 315,000, all of the pass-through income, even if it's service-related, now qualifies for that 20% deduction, right?
Correct, yeah.
Right, so that's a big deal, because if somebody is not doing any planning at all and makes more than that, then they could potentially not get the benefit of that pass-through deduction and have to pay significantly more in taxes, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, you're basically just leaving money on the table. If you've got, right, and always want to bring that back, right? If the client, if the dentist, if the practice owner's lifestyle that accommodates that amount, then that gives us just a great opportunity when we come to that stage of the year for income engineering for tax purposes. And one of the biggest arrows in our quiver for that income engineering is going to be that cash balance funding.
Yeah. So do you guys do taxes for people? Do you do financial planning and investing? Do you just advise in the practices? Like, what exactly does your group do?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're not going to be the ones to come in and actually prepare the tax return for the individual. We work very closely with our clients' accountants to kind of make sure that we're right-sizing that. So in this practice integrated wealth management process, you know, we think of wealth management, and traditionally when you think of a financial advisor or a wealth advisor, they're really focused on that personal side of things. there's a lot of good that needs to be done in that area. There's a ton of planning that needs to be done in that area. For me and my team, one of our passions is connecting the business aspect of it to the personal wealth management aspect of it for the majority of our clients. If that's not the sole source of income for the family, it is far and away the largest source of income for the family. And when we talked about those professions that we work with, the dentists, the attorneys, the vets, the optometrists, these are all people that went to school to become highly trained in their craft, in their clinical work, but they did not really have a lot of opportunity or a lot of free time to go get their MBA on the side, to go like we did, you know, get their CFA on the side, go and become a certified financial planner. So if we're able to take those tools and become the CFO for the office and the CFO for the household, then we can maximize the tax savings opportunities in a business. We can help them with some of the business decisions that they have to make. We can provide some of that capital analysis in terms of equipment purchases, in terms of how it is they're moving through their careers, and have that directly tie to a deep understanding of how do they define financial freedom? What is it that they want to get out of their career from that monetary perspective? And how does that support, you know, their family, their household, their legacy desires? When you've got all that working together, that's really where you can minimize the tax piece of it, maximize the pre-tax savings aspect of it, help them in terms of navigating their after-tax accounts, help them with their risk management and how they should be invested. Help them with the risk management from the insurance perspective and from the savings perspective, so that when we hit times like these for practice owners, you know, you're not as stressed as your peers are because you approached it with a plan that said, okay, what happens if I don't get any income for a 2 or 3 month period? Well, when you know when that looks like before the government tells you to shut down, you're able to sleep a lot better at night than when you're trying to discover that after the fact.
That particular example that you gave, you probably saved that person $150,000 in taxes.
Yeah. When we looked at what that tax savings was, otherwise we were coming in right about $175,000 for that Texas example. So, I mean, it can be some pretty heroic, but part of it too, and where we work with our accountants, we see this huge Section 179 deduction, and a lot of dentists want to go in if they do a build out or they do a large equipment purchase, try to write that all down in 1 year. One of the things that we're looking at is, what does your tax look like? What does that tax mitigation strategy look like for a 5-year period, for a 10-year period? Having 1 year of zero taxes might not be nearly as beneficial as having 5 years of, you know, a lower tax bill where we're playing those marginal rates to your benefit and not just necessarily trying to get the biggest bang in a single year.
Right, because a lot of people don't understand that. Yeah, there's a big jump up in marginal rates from the 24% to the 32% brackets, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's like a big difference because people just kind of assume that when you put money in pre-tax, it's all the same, and it's not, you know, because we have a progressive tax system where, you know, every dollar above a certain amount of income is taxed at this, you know, higher rate, and there's this huge jump between, I think it's $300,000 of joint income for a married couple, where it jumps up into that 30-something tax rate instead of the mid to low 20-somethings tax rate, right?
Exactly, right. And if you thread that needle, like we were talking about before with the QBI example, around that marginal differential, the 5-10-year tax savings that you have just becomes pretty awe-inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, most people don't pay their CPA for this level of wealth planning. I think they pay them for doing the forms, making sure that they're compliant with, you know, setting their wages for their S corporation, making sure, you know, maybe some CPAs will do evaluations for practices. Is that something that you guys do for clients, evaluate potential practice opportunities and purchasing and telling them what you think they're worth?
We do, right? I mean, a big part of all of our clients' net worth, now it should not be what they rely on for financial freedom, but a big part of their net worth is going to be the value of their business. So all of our Buckingham practice integration advisors are very familiar with how our practices in our specific industries are priced by the market. And so on an annual basis, we're going through and we're really kind of running that level of analysis so we can see that in their kind of in that net worth statement. Well, that same process becomes very valuable, particularly we talked about the clinician who happens to own a business versus the business owner who happens to be a clinician. For that individual who's looking at purchasing a practice, or if we're working with an associate who's looking to purchase a practice, we can come in and do a deep dive around that top to bottom analysis, that bottom to top analysis, make sure we're kind of kicking tires around what we're seeing across the US, what we're seeing with different geographies to make sure, yeah, pricing is correct. But then that next level, right? If a practice is priced fairly, then how are we going to be able to take advantage of that from a profit production standpoint? So that's the other area. When you kind of know, you know, what should hygiene be producing? What can a doc be producing? Doc owner be producing? What should an associate be producing? Helping them kind of see, okay, I'm looking at this practice. We've got a big price tag. I haven't bitten that off yet. All right, let's get to the financial model. Let's take a look at what does that practice valuation show us? Is it appropriate? What do different financing mechanisms mean in terms of cash flow? What do different changes in a practice that you purchase mean in terms of increased profitability? And when we kick a tire on that type of deal, you know, again, having a doctor go into that transaction, knowing what their plan is and how they're going to be able to take advantage of it, usually ends up in a much better result than, well, you know, it looked nice on paper, so I bought it. Now what?
Right. And, you know, I know Buckingham is one of the largest registered investment advisors in the country. And I know that, you know, you guys have looked to acquire some groups in growing. You run up against some of the same problems that a lot of professionals do, which is competing against private equity and determining what you think a business is worth, and then having to, you know, kind of draw a line in the sand where you say, well, we're just not going to compete against, you know, a food fight with private equity wanting to pay a ridiculous multiple for something. So, you know, I know that you guys have expertise in advising professionals for that, as well as actually experiencing some of the same frustrations that professionals go through, right?
I mean, it's 100%. As you look at the valuation multiples based off of size and how you're able to kind of make more efficient the back office side of things, as well as some of the management aspects of it, that's exactly right. When do you get in a bidding war? When is it not worth the bidding war? When do you let somebody else make a bad deal and understand that that was better for you as a practice owner, us as a firm, kind of all of those metrics? It's a different valuation process, but we're looking at the same type of result, which is ultimately going to be, once we buy this asset and we understand the cash flow from it, are we able to have a positive net present value, a positive internal rate of return? Are we actually able to extract the profit out of this that we thought we were going to?
So a couple quick questions. I don't want to dive too deep into y'all's investment methodology because it might confuse some people, you know, getting too technical, but I like to tell do-it-yourself investors that just buying a total market index fund is the best way to invest. And the reason I say that is just because it's extremely easy to maintain and grow wealth long-term. And you can stick with it. You don't have to worry about, you know, as many behavioral things where you might abandon a particular style of investing. But I know Buckingham is big into value investing and particular small cap investing because of some academic research that's called FAMA French model. Can you maybe in just a couple minutes explain why Buckingham believes that, and, you know, what are maybe some of the advantages of having, you know, an advisor follow a particular style of investing versus somebody just doing a total market approach?
Yeah. And I would commend that approach as well, right? When we look at the total market approach, if we're doing it with low cost funds, I would quickly state that's the second best way to do it. The way that, you know, we kind of see it, the FAMA French model was the one who kind of started us down the path of an empirical investing style, an evidence-based investing style. Now, there's been some great academic literature that peer-reviewed have incorporated that into our investment strategy after we've seen that be back-tested, cross-tested, and how we look at it moving forward. And ultimately, what we see in some of the factors that we invest in is a long-term excess return that is a risk-adjusted return, right? One of the things that we can't move away from is you're always going to have that correlation between risk and return. So at what level of risk is that return worth pursuing? And ultimately, when we look at factor investing versus being stock pickers versus trying to play kind of a forward-looking economy and getting a little, I'd almost say a little too cute and starting to pull away value from the client, one of the best buy and hold strategies that we've seen is that factor-based investing where we do lean a little bit towards small, we lean towards value, we lean towards momentum, and we lean towards quality in the types of funds that we use, still focused on what is the most price efficient fund so that any of that excess return does make its way to the client. But anytime that you're deviating from overall basket buy and hold, you'll have what we call factor drift. And so sometimes our investment strategy outperforms the market. Sometimes it underperforms the market. When we look at and when we see other academics really study the history of this style of investing, we see a persistence in that excess return, albeit, you know, there's certain timeframes where it's not present.
Yeah, and I think we've confused some people. I mean, the reality is just that any kind of investing is much better than not investing, first off, right? And then the second thing is when you're going to decide to invest, if you're doing it on your own, you want something that's easy to stick with. Total market investing is very easy to stick with and understand and get 90% of the way there. And then if you want, you know, the full best academically informed investing, I'll say this, that, you know, value investing has underperformed growth investing by quite a bit in the past 10 years because of the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, et cetera, right? And so given that that, you know, underperformance has happened, I think that it's a lot more likely, if you're trying to say what's more likely or less likely, it's a lot more likely that I think that small cap and value is more prone to, you know, maybe outperforming growth and, you know, these larger growth companies and big tech in the future. And I think that the problem is I would never tell somebody to go out and try to do that on their own, because sticking to an investment style for a decade of underperformance is near impossible feat as an individual from just a you know, an emotionally, wouldn't you say that?
And that's where I have to kind of take off my hat as this former economist and put on my hat as that financial advisor, and that 10 years of underperformance for a strategy from an economist's perspective is just a little drop in the bucket when we're talking about all of the data points that we're able to see this being supported. 10 years of underperformance for an individual investor is a significant portion of their investing life. And when you move away from a strategy after you've stuck to it for a long period of time, you know, that kind of shift of strategy is ultimately where we harm ourselves as individual investors. The other aspect that I'd kind of put out there to your audience is, even with full market strategy, one of the areas that discipline can be very difficult are in times exactly like now, right? I mean, when we saw what happened to the market as we've made our way through this pandemic, if you didn't have a good understanding of, even within that broad basket approach, how much am I holding in fixed income? What is my real risk tolerance? What does this portfolio look like when bad things happen? And can I pass that sleep test? Because regardless of what your strategy is, if you took risk off of the table when we went to our low and you weren't able to ride some of the recovery we've seen so far, and again, right, we've got no crystal ball. As I look to how does the rest of the recovery look like from here, we don't know what shape that's really going to take until we go through it. But if we deviate either from the equity strategy that we have or from our overall allocation in our portfolio to define our risk tolerance, that's ultimately where we end up seeing investors lock in losses, hurt themselves for the long term, and really just did not kind of right size against their risk tolerance and ability to sleep at night.
Yeah. And I want people to know that I invest with a tilt towards small cap stocks and value stocks and have for the past 10 years. I eat my own cooking. I don't tell people to do it because I think it's virtually impossible for somebody to get the right factor exposures and to stick with it during underperformance. I don't think it's a good strategy for somebody to try to implement on their own, but I think it's, you know, okay to implement with an advisor. A couple more questions with some considerations for people during this time. So when people say something like, you know, why didn't business owners have more stashed away for this crisis, right? Or considering things like getting access to bank lines of credit, or asking landlords for deferring rent, or banks for deferring practice loans. I mean, what sort of cash preservation techniques are you recommending to people right now?
When you buy that practice, when you've got kind of this profit machine that's coming out of there, if you don't take that perspective of the CFO, you know, how do we make sure that we're taking our good years to bolster ourselves against bad years? How do we prepare ourselves for the unexpected? It's really easy to be kind of drawing those dollars out, right? Like a lot of your listeners, before they get into thinking about their financial future, you know, every time we kind of see a raise, we think about, okay, how am I going to be able to spend these dollars versus, okay, how am I going to be able to save these dollars? When we work with our practices, we try to make sure that we've got at least 2 months of just total overhead operating expenses as cash on hand, the same way that we do on the personal side of having that emergency savings account. we want our practices to have an emergency savings account. So a lot of small businesses did not hit this type of disruption with that in place. One of the other things that we look at when we've got our high earnings years, when we're showing a great deal of profitability, that's a great time to get in place a line of credit and to have it there, but not to utilize it. Similarly, when we're looking at credit cards on the personal side of things, you know, there can be a lot of neat things that you're able to do in terms of getting points, in terms of, you know, kind of using that credit card to be able to expand your purchasing ability and strength versus carrying a whole bunch of debt. We don't want our lines of credits on the business side to be tapped on and utilized, but they can become a great buffer to make that 2 months worth of operating costs really extend for a long period of time. And then when you see a disruption, right, what is that immediate reaction that you have as a business owner if the perspective is only from the clinician side of things and I can't see patients and what do I do and I become reactionary versus, okay, I'm the business owner, I've got staff, I've got rent, I've got some overhead that's fixed. How do I bring down my variable overhead? How do I reach out to some of those lenders on the fixed cost side of things and immediately get into the negotiating side of things? You know, one of the things when I was in college, getting ready to go for an interview, walking out the door, and my dad hands me a $100 bill. And I say to him, look, Dad, I'm not going to give it back, but I am curious, why did you give me $100? So, well, you always have a lot more confidence at the table when you already have the cash in your pocket. When we've got 2 months of operating expense back there, when we've got a good line of credit, when we reach out to our lenders, we're not in a position where we're on the back of our heels. We're really able to lean in and negotiate, whether that be going interest only for a while, whether that be avoiding some of those monthly payments for a handful of months. Really, then what we're doing is we're protecting the war chest. We're not necessarily just trying to survive. And that's going to give us strength through a time like this. It's also going to give us a lot more opportunities when we get to the other side. And those who are more reactionary are a little bit more on their back feet.
So when you say bank line of credit, you're saying I could have, you know, $100,000 loan that I could draw on from a bank and I could pay that loan back over a period of 10 years or something if I need it? I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah. So a lot of times when we see our bank lines of credit, when you utilize, so it's a capital on hand that you don't need to access, but you're able to draw upon when you as the business owner desire to draw upon it. The majority of the repayment terms for a line of credit are going to be in interest only up and until, you know, whether that's a 5-year period or a 10-year period. So it also gives us the opportunity when we get back to business as normal or when we get back to business as the new normal to kind of structure within our cash flow what's going to be our most advantageous way to pay this back and reestablish and keep that line of credit. Now, it's basically a bank loan that we kind of put on the shelf and leave to the side and only access it when we need it. And the best terms to get a line of credit are when you're profitable, credit worthy, and when you've got revenue coming into your business.
Yeah. So in other words, get that in place. And then, you know, if you have this pandemic that comes along and you need 3 to 4 months of help, right, until you're able to get back to normal, certainly people think that we'll be back to normal 5 years from now. I guess nobody's calling for, you know, shutdowns for 5 years. So that's basically taking some of those good times and borrowing against that if needed to cover some of these lean times so that you keep the business healthy and profitable and still growing value in the equity of it.
That's exactly it. Yep, you got it.
Yeah. What are you telling people about the PPP program? Are you recommending people participate in that, the Paycheck Protection Program, for covering payroll and some other small expenses?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I certainly am. And that's been a huge focus of where our time has been spent over these past couple of months. You know, anytime you've got the federal government as your lender, how that loan program works isn't going to necessarily be tied to common sense or how a business would think about, you know, how they get access to capital. So there's a lot of fine points when it comes to that PPP program. But if navigated correctly, it gives you some great opportunity to get back, right? Particularly for our dentists that were mandated to shut down. When we start seeing patients again, our production is going to front run our collections, which is going to front run our profit. So if we've got a source of forgivable capital that allows us to bring our staff back, allows us to pay ourselves, and allows us to cover a portion of those fixed costs, namely rent and certain utilities, then that's going to be wonderful capital to utilize. Now, you know, there's all of these rules and restrictions that come with the PPP program, and happy to unpack a lot of those. But we're going to see those who are cautious with how they use the PPP understand, or have an advisor who understands how that program works, are going to be the best set to get the forgiveness at the end of it. Don't look at it as a pot of capital. Don't look at it as you would a normal loan from a bank, but ultimately look at those forgivable expenses, that forgivable timeline, and some of the ways that you need to handle your staff to maximize the forgiveness, because they're dollars that are going to be forgiven and are not going to be taxed, and they can become a great lifeline to building back up and getting back to normal, new normal, or the next phase of what this all looks like.
And thinking about what the next new normal looks like, I mean, for people who are not already practice owners, what do you think they need to do to get their finances in shape to buy a practice, say, in the next year or two?
I mean, the biggie is going to be kind of ensuring from that personal level that we've got the credit worthiness, keep an eye on kind of how it is you're managing your cash flow around your debt obligations, and ultimately just getting yourself in a position to understand what practice ownership looks like. We don't know what's going to happen to practice values as we come out of this crazy disruption. If it was a singular practice or a singular geography that was affected, we'd have some of these comparable expectations that, okay, those practices are going to receive a very negative kind of result on the valuation side of it. Now, when an entire industry gets hit like something like this, yeah, I mean, you and I can both say we've not seen anything like this in our life. So how are valuations going to be right size? Not 100% sure. But when it comes to the valuation of a business, you can never extract that or separate that from the fact that you're actually just valuing cash flow and you're putting a market rate on it. So the expectation is going to be that a lot of practice valuations are going to decrease. With that decrease in a future looking normal, then there's great opportunity to buy a cash flow asset that we expect the cash flow to increase into the future. So for a lot of associates who were thinking, is now a good time to buy a practice? You know, in the next year or two is probably going to be one of the better times for them to put their foot in the water and really kind of start to review and try to locate a practice that works for them.
The rumor mill that I've heard is that the amount of money that they're going to want to see in liquidity is going up from maybe an average of 3% before this recession to maybe 10% of a practice valuation after this recession. Do you think that's something that might happen?
You know, it might. You know, trying to really define what does that future look like, I think we're not going to really know it until we get there. Using that multiple that you said before in terms of 3% of the practice value versus the 10% of the practice value, you know, from that financial advisory perspective, from that CFO perspective, would always say, you know, if we're able to demonstrate that 10% net worth against what the value of the practice looks like and kind of that ability to manage the debt that would come from that practice purchase, you know, all that becomes easier from the cash flow perspective. We're not necessarily leveraging so much in terms of dollars we don't yet have, which is a good position to be in if you're buying an asset like a business.
You know, in other words, if you do want to be a practice owner after this, I think that if you want to be a little cautious, maybe try to have a little bit more in cash than you think you need. You know, it's always amusing to me, Tom, how much people are concerned about getting a down payment available for a house when they don't think about getting a down payment available for, you know, their practice purchase, which is going to give them the ability to buy probably whatever house they want long term. You know, I mean, it's interesting to see people, because a lot of times, you know, you can get a zero down mortgage, especially as a lot of healthcare professionals can get this. And the only difference is you're paying maybe an extra 0.5% on your mortgage rate, but people are so focused on getting the 20% down for the house, and then they neglect the practice planning side, which is, I understand why people do it, but it's just always mind-blowing when I see such a focus on that.
Yeah, no, I could not agree more, right? I mean, as we think about how we're staging our career, how we're staging our life. You know, one of the things that I love about your podcast and the work that you do, it's really forcing people and it's really asking people to look forward and say, okay, what's the ideal end result? So then how does that prioritize how we're managing our debt, how we're saving for our assets, and how we kind of put those things in order? 100%. I've got several practice owners who are new to the practice ownership who did prioritize, I want to buy the practice before we look at, you know, that long-term beautiful home that we desire as a family. and they're finding, you know, from income and from savings ability, oh, my budget just went from $500,000 to $1 million for my primary residence. And, you know, what is that percentage of cash flow coming into the house? Also, in terms of debt obligation, also shrunk significantly because their earnings potential was so accelerated when they did purchase the practice.
Yeah. So I never like talking about cost without thinking about value. That's something that a business owner thinks a lot about. If something's going to give me a lot higher returns or savings, then it's worth paying a lot more for versus, you know, I'm shopping for thing of masking tape and I want to find the cheapest cost, right? I mean, it's a different kind of, well, it's a different kind of mindset, but just so that people know that they don't have to have millions of dollars to work with you guys, you know, what is the price range for services, maybe for somebody who's say just starting out versus somebody you're saving $200,000 in taxes for?
Great question. So one of the things that I love about the practice integrated wealth management offering is that ability to really support a client who wants to be a business owner and getting to the level of wealth as quickly as possible. So when we engage in a practice integrated wealth management client and start working with, you know, maybe it's an associate who wants to buy a practice in the upcoming year, I'm not going to be as guarded about the assets under management aspect as I am about, okay, are we serious about buying that practice? And that practice CFO level service comes at a monthly cost. That monthly cost is then going to cover the services that we offer, going to provide us the opportunity for tax planning, going to provide us the opportunity for personal wealth management, and for putting together a financial plan for the practice. Ultimately, it's great in our line of business where we're managing $1 million or a $2 million client, and we're really focused on the investment side, and we're really focused on the personal wealth management and financial planning side. Being able to have that monthly charge as it comes to the CFO level service for the practice allows us to start that relationship significantly earlier. Not going to be where I'd say, look, if you don't have $500,000, don't give me a call. No, if you've got whatever amount there, but you're serious about wealth creation, you're serious about practice ownership, and you understand that having that CFO in the relationship, helping think about your business from the CEO perspective, not just the clinical perspective, that monthly fee is going to allow us to be able to work with really anybody out there who's listening, who's thinking about a practice purchase now.
For somebody who's just starting out, it's like a four-figure sum annually.
Yeah.
Just to get started, like, you know, low to mid four-figure, like minimum fee just to get started. And it can be more if it's more complicated than that. But for that kind of a fee that can save you six figures of overpaying for a bad practice that you bought, or six figures annually potentially in tax savings because you didn't understand cash balance plans and, you know, reducing AGI, and your CPA is not having detailed conversations with you about advanced tax planning strategies, talking about the QBI deduction went over probably 99% of people's heads listening to this. But it's kind of like what I like to tell people is if you are a do-it-yourselfer, do not worry about hiring a financial planner, because you're probably going to care so deeply about your personal finances because you're going to have a super high savings rate, and that papers over a lot of mistakes. And then for people who, you know, are wanting to be associates long term, don't have a very complicated financial picture, it's kind of like the difference between hiring somebody that's a CPA versus doing TurboTax, right? If you've got a really simple financial picture, then yeah, get enough term and disability insurance, max out your 401k, put $1,000 a month into a Vanguard mutual fund, maybe hire like a robo advisor or something for your financial planning. That'll be just fine. And then if you are in this scenario where you're interested in getting to $5, $10, $20 million of net worth, you want to have a large private practice to help you achieve your financial goals much sooner, and you want to succeed against all the private equity and complicated business landscape that exists, also without having to, you know, a lot of people, they tell me the biggest opposition they have to practice ownership is, I just want to go home and turn off the lights. And it's like, well, you can do that if you freaking hire somebody to worry about all those other things. Yeah, if you don't hire somebody to worry about all those things, then yeah, you're living in the mansion, but you're cutting the grass, tending the sculptures, making sure the fountain fires water, you know, in the air. I'm joking around a little bit here, but you get the idea. It's kind of like, yeah, if you hire professionals, you don't have to worry about all that stuff and you're way richer.
Where is your time most profitably spent? Is it really going to be taking off day 4 or taking off day 5 of your clinical work to start reading the finance text that, you know, you and I have had to drudge through over that multi-year process of getting a CFA, of, you know, really digging in and going back to try to get an MBA, or, you know, like in the case of dentistry, is your most profitable time spending that in your patients' mouths? If that's the case, then leverage some of the time that it otherwise would take by bringing in some of that professional team so that you can focus on what makes the profit, and you've got a team to help you really maximize what does that profit look like from a take-home perspective, what does that take-home perspective mean in terms of your overall wealth creation, and how can you kind of balance, like you were saying, you know, yeah, I want to come home, spend time with the family. I don't want to necessarily come home and start researching, what's a cash balance plan? How does paired plan testing work? What's QBI? And what's the latest tax law actually mean for me as a business owner? Similarly, you know, we're not going to be spending our time trying to figure out how to do a hygiene appointment at home.
And the other thing is, you know, Vanguard or Betterment Financial Planning, I have a high regard for those services, but they're not going to have those conversations with you. Those are too complicated. Those are not cookie cutter kind of approaches where it's just not going to make sense for them to be informed about those kind of questions. So, you know, so if you're looking to be a practice owner or already are, and you're a, you know, dentist, veterinarian, physician for some specialties, optometrist, veterinary, I forget if I mentioned everything, you know, lawyer, right? If you're in that kind of sweet spot, and they're willing to potentially spend some sort of four-figure annual number to try to hit these practice goals that they have, what are the next steps? Can they talk to you? You have a free introductory meeting to see if it makes sense to work together.
That's it, right? I mean, I think one of the things that you've seen with Buckingham in our relationship over time, we're fiduciary advisors. We're going to act in the best interests of our clients. And I believe that that starts with those introductory conversations that we have that are, you know, no cost, risk-free. If I can't come in and kind of identify for you a couple of implementation items that'll frankly cover the first several years of our fees, then it might not make sense to move forward. But, you know, more often than not, there are those tweaks, there are those kind of low-hanging fruit items that we're able to really start introducing for a practice owner that give them immediate value. And so if you want to have that conversation, you know, shoot me a quick email at tboden@buckinghamgroup.com. Give me a call, 317-460-0153, or even just hopping onto Buckingham's website and starting the conversation there at buckinghamadvisors.com. Any of those paths are going to work. Myself, my team are here to start those conversations and make sure that, you know, so much of what we had the opportunity to talk about today are these broad trends and talking about the industries as a whole and the service as a whole. But where the rubber hits the road is ultimately going to be in your practice and with your plan. And so if you heard the conversation, there's some things you're curious about, please reach out. Always happy to have that conversation. There's no cost to it, no risk to it.
You could also just Google you. So Tom Boden, B-O-D-I-N, and you're going to show up and you click on that profile that you have at the Buckingham site, and that your email is listed right there too. If people are worried about spelling that right, they can find it right there. And again, you know, fee-only fiduciary investment advisors, you understand the tax piece, you do complicated work that saves people six figures in a lot of cases annually. That's kind of why I wanted to have you guys on the show. And again, if you do end up deciding to work with them, you help support Student Loan Planner because Buckingham is a sponsor of Student Loan Planner. So thank you, Tom, for being on the show. Hopefully we can help some people save a lot of money. Does that sound good?
Sounds like a plan. I really appreciate it, Travis. Thanks for having me on. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you for listening to today's show. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, you can schedule one today at studentloanplanner.com/book. You can find the show notes for today's episode at studentloanplanner.com/the number of the episode. And finally, if you like the podcast, leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you. Have a great week.